Once upon a time, a tiny infant. Okay, well, maybe not all that tiny of an infant, but an infant nonetheless. Once upon a time, this infant, in a fit of lethargy, bored to death on a business trip in a hotel room, on a whim, as a lark, decided to peep into his stones and write the new Book of Abraham. Chapter 1 was published in March 2015. Chapter 2 followed a few months later, in July. Chapter 3 would have to wait a year and a few months until October 2016. And now, at long last, in a live recording in front of a small group of people in Mesa, Arizona, this not-so-tiny infant finishes what he began 3 years ago, the final two chapters of the new Book of Abraham. To keep up on future Wednesday night live recordings, check out our Facebook page. And to hear the first three chapters of the new Book of Abraham, just keep listening to the end of this live recording. They will be included as Easter eggs. Now, how about that infant's intro, huh?
This is Infants on Thrones, the philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the core.
Welcome back to Infants on Thrones. I'm Glenn Ostlund, and what you're about to hear was recorded live tonight, Wednesday, March 7th. And we're going to start doing this on a regular basis until we don't, but I don't know how long that's going to be. So if you're in the Phoenix area and you want to come out and see me and Matt and sometimes Scott, the local Arizona infants, talk about stuff and record it, and you can be part of the conversation like the people you're going to hear tonight, well, come out. Details are on our Facebook page. It's at the Community of Christ Church in Mesa, Arizona, and we're going to be doing it Wednesday nights from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. You'll hear more about it in this discussion. So let's just go with that, shall we? We'll do it. Let's just do it. Okay, well, I think we're ready to go. So thanks for coming out. Like, it's short notice, and it was really at Sunstone last Sunday that Matt and I thought, and quite independently of each other, it's kind of funny. Matt, I'm recording, man. I need sound purity. I had this idea a couple of weeks ago that's called Shadow the Lamanite, that I'll talk about a little bit later. And it's basically rewriting the Book of Mormon from the perspective of Shadow the Lamanite. And as I was thinking about it, I thought about this Book of Abraham, the new Book of Abraham thing that I started 3 years ago. And I did chapter one in March, 2015? And then I did chapter two the following July. It took me a year and a couple of months, October of 2016, to do chapter three. And it's been a year and a half. I haven't done anything on it since. But chapter three, if you have your marijuana prescription from the state of Arizona, that's a good one to listen to that with some medicine there. But anyway, you know, so I haven't finished it. And one of the things I did with that was so fun was I would take each verse and I would just kind of like twisted and just play around with it and put a lot of snark into it. And the things that always bothered me about the Book of Abraham, I would just really highlight those things in it. And it got to chapters 4 and 5 of the Book of Abraham, which is really just Genesis 1 and 2, you know, the creation story and then starting with Adam and Eve. And then it's like Joseph Smith got bored or something and he just dropped it because it's, you know, there's nothing there. And I started a couple of times trying to do this creation thing, trying to go verse for verse, twisting it around like I had the other ones, and I couldn't do it. So when I got this idea about Shadow the Lamanite, I thought, I want to wrap up the new Book of Abraham before I start in on the Book of Mormon. So I need to figure out how I would wrap that up. And, you know, over the last year, reading Sapiens. Have you guys read Sapiens? No, you have. We've talked about it. Have you guys read it? Did you read it, Matt?
Yeah, I listened to most of it.
Most
of it,
yeah.
But I talk to you all the time.
So right, right. I feel like I've got it. Yeah, right. So Sapiens, stuff from Jonathan Haidt, Short History of Nearly Everything. One of the things I don't think that I've talked about on the podcast, but has been like really influential on me, is Brian Greene's Fabric of the Cosmos, which was a book that he wrote. But Nova also did a four-part series. Like, what is time? What is space? What is, like, the universe or multiverse? You know, quantum mechanics and stuff is just, like, totally interesting. So all of these things kind of form this little germ in me that you're going to hear tonight with the Book of Abraham, chapters 4 and 5. So I've departed from the verse-to-verse, like, twisting around approach that I did before, and I just started writing what I would write if I was channeling the spirit of Abraham via the spirit of Joseph Smith, via the spirit of me, whatever that is. So here we go. And then we're going to go through two chapters. The New Book of Abraham, chapters 4 and 5. In the beginning, there was energy, pure energy, powerful energy, conscious and omniscient energy, free-floating, eternal, highly creative, omnipotent, perfected, been there, done that, no stone left unturned in this universe, pure, powerful energy. And it was bored. It had done everything there is to do an infinite number of times, tasted everything there was to taste, built everything there was to build, explored every mystery there was to explore, mastered every skill there was to master, marked every tree there was to mark, screwed, madeth love to everything there was to maketh love to. Eternal existence had just become so humdrum, so super lame. Again. So the bored eternal energy did what bored eternal energy always does at this point in its existence. It shook things up. It isolated each and every one of its smallest, most comprehensive, self-sustaining units of consciousness. Highly potent, highly creative, massively concentrated energy bundles. Some have called these souls. Trillions upon trillions of tiny, concentrated, mashed-up, string-shaped bundles of unimaginably creative, powerful, quantum-level, stringy energy. And each one of these souls said goodbye to their fellow trillion or so energy buddies and split up, departing from the mass of eternal energy they had once become so intrinsically a part of, and ventured off into their own newly created dimensions to form their own brand new universes within the vast eternal network of previously spawned multiverses. Another new and expanding hole in the Swiss cheese fabric of reality, splitting off out of boredom with the status quo to create new energies, new matter, new experiences, new things to taste, new things to build, new mysteries to discover, new skills to master, new things to screw. In other words, they banged. Bigly. And one of those big bangs created this universe that we are now a part of. And the quantumly stringy soul energy from which this universe was formed filled the new expanse with all of its potent, creative, conscious energy. A new eternal sandbox connected at every level by the energy that created it. And once again, life began anew in the form of stars and planets and all imaginable and unimaginable forms of interstellar life, some that have already been identified by modern scientific tools, but most far beyond our limited ability to recognize or understand, all expanded from and connected to this one source of eternal conscious intelligence from which it sprang, including, of course, the conscious, intelligent life energy that formed this planet, Earth. And upon this Earth, like everywhere else in this new universe, life began the ascent towards eternal, energetic perfection through the long, slow, evolutionary process of struggling against and adapting to the hostile environment in which it found itself, a hostile environment that would shape and mold what was growing within it. Small evolutionary successes among millions of evolutionary failures. Stronger life arising from weaker life. A gradual cycle of improvement in a perfectly near homeostatic balance of two steps forward, one step back. The successes expressing gratitude and respect and appreciation for the failures, realizing that its own failures would be the stepping stones for future adaptation and success along a very long and slow evolutionary path. And thus it was that life on this earth began to multiply and expand, creating new forms of physical matter to merge with, to animate, to inhabit, to experience, to suffer, to fail, to adapt, to succeed, to taste, to explore, to screw, to enjoy. Physical matter developed in amazing and diverse ways, animated by this fragment source energy for its own growth and enjoyment and perfection. Membranes formed around cells, creating supercells. Supercells diversified and adapted to survive in their hostile environments. Brains began to form, specializing in memory and recall, gathering and storing and accessing as much data as it could to anticipate and protect itself from those hostile environmental things that would otherwise harm life. It also evolved reward mechanisms to protect and promote life. Becoming more sensitive to the environment around it, some specialized groups of cells became sensitive to chemical traces in the surrounding environment and evolved into a sense of smell and then of taste. Other specialized cells became sensitive to light and evolved a way to find meaning through photons. Those became eyes. Other cells specialized to find meaning in sound waves, others towards physical touch, and yet still others evolved a sensitivity towards things we have no language yet to describe. Thus it is for all forms of life along the slow path of evolution. And one of these forms of life evolved into something that eventually evolved to think of itself as unique and separate cells. This was a tremendous boon to progress and survival. It began to imagine it was unique, and its own peculiar existence set it apart, even if ever so slightly, from its hundreds of thousands of brothers and sisters and cousins, all parts of the same eternal source of life found everywhere within the universe. This biology began thinking that it was a separate living thing, that it was the very reason the universe was created in the first place. This form of life would self-identify as human and would come to create entire civilizations around the belief that they were separate and superior to all other forms of life, both around it and within it. And these human life forms told each other stories, powerful fictions, inventing belief-shaping myths that allowed them to cooperate in large groups, to adapt even more effectively to their hostile, natural environment, even to the point of accelerating those hostilities, which in turn accelerated their own biological adaptations, progressing in knowledge and understanding at a rate far faster than their previous biological evolution had allowed. And it was the power of language, particularly of myth, that artificially but effectively bound these humans together in a new sense of separateness. And that's the end of chapter 4. What do you think? Like it? Is it weird? Is it like a weird thing for Infants on Thrones, or is it kind of like...
I mean, not now.
Not now. What do you mean by that, Matt?
What's weird now?
Yeah.
Maybe at one point it would have been, but...
Yeah.
Just...
All right.
No, yeah, I mean, I don't think it's weird. It's, but I don't know. I've been living in this same space...
With me for a few months, yeah.
So I'm just like, yeah, all right.
Yeah.
Holy Richard.
Yeah.
We just make it the new chapter 1.
What's that?
Can we just make it a new chapter?
The new origin myth of the universe. I mean, it's already kind of pieces of stuff that's already out there. But okay, chapter 5. And one of the most powerful of these myths was about a man named Adam, the first man, and a woman named Eve, the first woman. Or in some versions, the second, because Lilith wanted to screw, or maketh love to Adam from atop rather than supine. Do you guys know that? The Lilith myth?
Oh, yeah. I am not familiar.
Yeah, in Middle Eastern mythology, the first man and woman was Adam and Lilith, and Lilith would not submit to Adam. And so Adam asked God to get rid of her and create someone subordinate to him. So he created Eve. And Lilith became like a monster, like a demon that kills babies and stuff like that. And
Adam gave her a bomb.
She became the mother of the genies that are the malevolent spirits in Middle Eastern. Yeah. That's what a degree in folklore will get you. And because so many humans believed this and its associated myths in so many of their variations, those associated beliefs began to shape the world, creating powerfully effective yet artificial social norms and expected behaviors. But buried in each of these myths were true and valuable insights, paths to reconnecting to and recommuning with the initial source of eternal conscious intelligence that all living things are still, even in their own biologically created illusion of separateness, such significantly insignificant parts of. For Adam and Eve in this story came to certain insights and realizations that led to their ultimate separation from other forms of life on this earth, and their isolated sense of separation from their divine natures. Some of those insights will be detailed below. Other insights, the most powerful insights, will only come from your own reading and interpretation of this myth. But first and foremost, curiosity killeth cats. The first lesson from this story is that progress requires sacrifice. Progress cannot be achieved without sadness and separation. Yea, verily, even unto death and sin. I was trying to get all scriptural there. Judgment and shame compel us today, much as it did to the mythical Adam and Eve, to cover our vulnerabilities and isolate ourselves from paradisiacal Eden. Judgment happens the moment people begin to label things as either right or wrong. That judgment leads to isolation. That isolation leads to pain. That pain is a necessary hostility added to our environment that we must adapt to overcome. For within the soul of each and every one of us is the potential to grow and expand that divine eternal source within us, to progress eternally, to become united with the fullness of that powerful, omniscient, destined for eternal boredom energy that at some point will start the cycle all over again. Again. The cycle we see mirrored in nature all around us. The cycle we see mirrored in our mythology. The cycle we create in our own works of fiction. Like this work of fiction we are all creating together right now. So here we sit in an environment as hostile, if not more so, as any hostility we have faced in the past. Here we sit with the innate power and ability to adapt, even beyond our former biological abilities to do so. And it's time for us to wake up. It's time for us to return from our biologically imposed sense of isolation, to make this world once more an Eden. It's time for a new sense to evolve, like the sense of touch, of taste, of smell, of sound, of sight. A sense that awakens us to the truth of our connection to each other and to all living things. A sense through which we can sense truths within and beyond mythologies, beyond the fictions, beyond observable facts. The truth inside of each of us that is a divine spark of eternal energy, that is your true inner voice that speaks to you, that is speaking through me right now, that is telling you to laugh at ridiculous things, to enjoy the world you live in, to calm your minds, to relax, to let go of fear to live. That eternal piece of you that is constantly struggling against your own internal hostile conditions. Those hostile conditions of our own biology that evolved to protect us from danger, from being destroyed by the unknown. The amygdala in our brains, our fight or flight response, the parts of us that unconsciously store every piece of data we encounter, that communicates warning signals through our feelings and emotions, that makes us fear and cautiously avoid the dangerous and the unknown. That piece of us that is fueled by our unconscious moral framework, that Hulk smashes any who would oppose us, that mourns and freaks out with every new school shooting and Russia collusion and Kofaprisi tweet. That piece of us that slowly evolved in a near homeostatic balance for hundreds of thousands of years, slowly adapting to new hostilities in our environment until the advent of mass media, which flooded us with more hostility than we could handle, raising the sense of alarm in our brains to the critical state we are now in, a state where suspicion and mistrust are now our default conditions, where fear, isolation, detachment, dishonesty, criticism, cruelty, exploitation, obstinance, hatred, judgment, apathy, offense, and hopelessness have become our daily nectar to which we all are currently addicted, fed to us through our televisions, through our media, through our phones. This is the inner hostility pressing down against that pure divine inner self that is trying to adapt and evolve. To adapt and evolve life after life, death after death, rebirth after rebirth, in a pattern we see reflected in nature all around us. Until our awareness of who we are, of how connected we are to life, of the impact we have on the hostility of the environment around us expands to match the level of alarm constantly being consumed. But even now, salvation can be found within. Salvation from the increasingly toxic cycle of fear. Salvation in the rediscovery and reconstruction of the true inner you, the source of your creativity and compassion, your kindness, your laughter, your love, your joy. Salvation in healing through fictions, through learning to fully love who you are as you are, without the need to beat yourself up over not becoming something that someone else has told you that you need to become. Truly coming to heal and love yourself and helping others to learn to heal and love themselves for exactly who they are, abnormalities and all. And thus I make an end to the new book of Abraham. For I am the disembodied voice of the real, actual Abraham, speaking through the disembodied voice of Joseph Smith, speaking to you now from the depths of your true inner selves that have been drawn to ponder upon the ridiculous words and hit-and-miss efforts of Glenn Ostlund from Infants on Thrones. It's time to stop simply taking apart the things from our Mormon faith that did not serve us. It's time to start building back and strengthening those things that do. This is only the beginning of a new creative burst of infant energy, which I invite you to contribute to and support in any way you can, Jake. I'm just teasing you. The philosophies of men mingled with humor and fiction, born again out of boredom, for your enjoyment and consideration. And thus I bid you an Abrahamic adieu and open the door for Shadow, the Lamanite. More of this to come. Thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones.
Infants on Thrones!
I don't know. So what? It felt preachy. Did it feel preachy?
Just when you were preaching.
Just when I was preaching? So let's talk about it. I want to hear from you. If there's anything to say.
I think it's funny that you asked if it sounds preachy, because it's one of those things where I feel like if you discover something that helped you that you think could help other people,
yeah,
there's really like no good way of doing that without sounding like, you know, because you're always only experiencing your own experience. You don't know what other people are going through. And so It seems like that's always a tricky. That's always a conundrum.
It is, and especially because so much of, like, what I've done with Infants on Thrones over the last 5.5 years, and even before that, with Mormon Expression. You know, I had this voice in my head that was probably John Larson at one point, you know, and others that are like, that's stupid. Mm-hmm. No, don't say that. That's dumb. Oh, you sound like them. You know, it's all those things that, like, I'm kind of identifying as my own inner shadow, that part of me that is like the fear that kind of holds me back from saying what I want to say. And if it is something that's helpful to other people, great. If it's not, okay. But it's like... That worry about being preachy or coming across differently from what people expect from Infants on Thrones, that's all totally, like, wrapped up in all this. So, I don't know.
Yeah. To me, it, just listening to you, it just reminds me or makes me think about how Scripture actually gets created. I mean, because what you're saying is, you know, based on scientific knowledge and things we know right now, and I, you know, fast forward 200 years and now somebody's reading what you just wrote, you know, as, oh, this is what they believed, and
hopefully
it sounds,
not hopefully hopefully it's clear that, like, I'm aware that I'm writing a fiction, you know, right. And that, like, I'm not trying to pass this off as, you know, so like I talk about Shadow the Lamanite at the end, and this idea that I have to take this kind of approach to the Book of Mormon is to say I think that the Book of Mormon would be much better as a fiction, because the idea that there were actually Lamanites, especially, that were wicked and had their skin color changed as a result of it is so offensive to so many people. You know, like, how are you even going to be able to approach, if there is something good in the Book of Mormon to take out of it, how can you even get past things like that? Or that there weren't swords, there weren't, you know, iron, or, you know, like that whole list of... What was the guy on Mormon Stories? Michael Coe, is that his name?
Oh, yeah.
They went down that whole list of things, you know, that when you go down that path about the literalness or historicity of the Book of Mormon, it falls apart. And so trying to salvage at least those parts of it that I found valuable, and trying to rediscover that as part of it as well, and then also to play with the things that are just ludicrous and ridiculous about it, because I value that too. You know, I value the humor that comes from seeing the incongruity of what this is, what, you know, the Book of Mormon says is and what actually isn't. But then somewhere in between that space, there's got to be, like, some lessons to learn. And so to present that in a way that is very clearly, obviously fiction and satire, I would hope, if we're even around in 200 years, if somebody looked at it, they don't go, oh, well, that was Scripture. They're like, oh, that was satire. And, you know, but there's things that we can learn from that.
Yeah, too. Maybe in, like, Planet of the Apes time, they'll come across this and be like, this will be the new religion back in the future. One you will have created.
It's always a possibility.
Religion. So you want religion to...
Yeah. And you made a reference to your other book that's forthcoming.
That's right.
scripture reference.
Yeah. Yeah, and probably in Shadow of the Lamanite there will be a Glenn who's the son of Glenn who writes it. Which I actually am, aren't I, Ryan? I am a Glenn son of Glenn, so we can look forward to that in Shadow of the Lamanite.
I like what you said. I was talking to Jake earlier tonight about the documentary, whatever you want to call it, Religulous.
Oh, yeah.
Bill Maher.
Bill Maher, yeah.
And it was hilarious, but it was really sobering at the end, because he really drives it home. Like...
Talk about preachy.
Yeah,
that's like the like. I was so critical of Bill Maher at the way he got so preachy at the end of that. I'm like, damn it! Sometimes I feel like I'm Bill Maher. Anyway, go ahead, Paul.
But it's the biggest things that we fear today are differences in beliefs. Mm. Basically, that's what's tearing the world apart a lot of times, and that's what's scary. And I like the fact that you put in there, you know, we need to just enjoy the things about life that there are to enjoy and stop being divided on all these things.
Yeah.
Because there's so many people that believe that the culmination of the earth is at the end of it, and that's what the purpose is to end here pretty soon, and that's it's just a scary thought how many people believe that, and if we can help people to dissipate those things.
Yeah, to relax, because yeah. I really do think that we get so many messages of like fear and like so many things to worry about that we just can't handle it, and we're strung so tight that then we become really sensitive when something real comes by, you know, but we're so shut off to it and in this constant state of panic that like relaxing about stuff would be really healthy. I do want to talk about religious for a minute, because we did an episode on it, one of the first episodes of Infants, we did a review of it, and I don't think I've even gone back and watched it since then, even though I watch Bill Maher from time to time. But one of my biggest critiques of that is that he would say that there's a part of where he's like, I preach the gospel of I don't know. I preach the gospel of doubt. And I'm like, bullshit. You know, you're not treating any of these people like you don't know that what they're saying could be true. You're very certain about what you're certain about. And like that lack of awareness and humility, and you can't even say humility and Bill Maher in the same sentence, you know. And that, like, that's something that's always bothered me about him, and like presenting it as the gospel of doubt. And you're like, yeah, that's good. You should be able to doubt and not hold so tight to your dogmatic certainties. But yeah, he doesn't really do that, and it just became so much about ridicule. And I think it was the section on Mormons where he's talking with. Who was it? The singer.
What's his name? She's So High singer.
Yeah.
Can't think of his name.
And he's like really interested in talking with him about like Mormon history and the weird things from Mormonism. And like Bill Maher's just like, so like, okay, next. Yeah, that's dumb. Next. Yeah, that's dumb. Yeah, that's dumb. Look, it's all dumb. I'm like, no, like, let's talk about it. I want to hear more about that. But, yeah. Taj. Name Taz something, I don't know. Anyway, you were going to say something,
Greg. I think when you're transparent about it being a fiction, that allows people to relax, right? Like I hadn't thought about if the Book of Mormon had been presented in the beginning as, hey, this is just a fiction, you guys, this is just like a metaphor for us to all learn from. I could almost see Mormonism becoming almost like a like as progressive as like the Jewish religion is today, where, you know, you take what's good and you don't worry about the details of it.
Maybe it may have just fallen apart too. It like Mormonism may have needed that galvanizing insanity of, you know, like firm, unshakable belief to even form a thing. And, you know, it's possible that way. But I've wondered if Joseph Smith felt like he, like maybe felt embarrassed about creating it, and like that he had to kind of pass it off as a real thing, even to the point of like fabricating these gold plates that he would carry around and make people think that it was real, or else they would make fun of him, or, you know, something like that. So it was like his insecurity that he couldn't get past to say, yeah, I'm writing this story actually, you guys. And I've got some insights that are pretty good on it, but
and then you could hide behind it if something's wrong with it, right?
Yeah. It's not, if there are errors, they're the errors of men. It's not me. Not me. Yeah. Cool. Well, Matt, do you want to talk at all about what we want to do with these Wednesday nights, and, you know, how we're gonna?
Well, do I need to be close to the mic, because this is for our listeners as well, right?
Yeah.
Well,
why don't you come up closer?
Come up closer. Can I sit on your lap?
It's a pretty weak chair.
All right.
Oops. Oh, that's a literal throne room.
Yeah, true infant on a throne now.
That's right.
Right. Well, we're just kind of making up as we go, aren't we?
Yeah, it's funny. And I think I started telling you guys this, that on Sunday at Sunstone, Hillary Jenkins came up to me, and he's a member of the congregation here, and, you know, he was talking about how their activity has kind of fallen off, and like they have this building, they want to have people come and use it for the kinds of things that were being talked about at Sunstone, but people hadn't. And I said, you know, I've
I've got this idea for a Shadow the Lamanite thing. I could do like a chapter a week and like have discussions and get feedback, and that could be something that actually helps me write it as I get feedback from people. And he's like, oh, that sounds cool. Wednesday nights would work. And then Matt approached him completely independent of me and said, I've got some things I want to do on Wednesday night. And Hillary's like, oh, you've talked to Glenn about this, right? Like,
coordinate with Glenn. Like, no.
Glenn?
But I guess I will. Who's this Glenn guy? So we were kind of doing these things independently and realized, wait, we have a podcast. And we've been working together for like 5 years. Maybe we could... Peanut butter and chocolate. Let's put our hands together.
Peanut butter and chocolate. Oh, yeah, okay. I was thinking jelly.
Doing a commercial. You got me. Chocolate in my peanut butter.
Peanut butter stuck in my chocolate.
Let's go. Together, they taste like crap. Yeah. So instead, we decided just to start doing these on Wednesdays. We'd alternate. I'd do my presentations, my ideas, which are really an application of what I've been talking around on a couple of the podcasts recently, and then in a Sunstone presentation, which is just educating people on the realities of abuse. And initially I said, you know, about sexual abuse, because that's where my particular training is. But as I've, you know, I've also done a lot of work with physical abuse, kids, domestic violence. I was involved in sex crimes, which was the primary number of cases, but it was the special victims unit, which includes domestic violence, physical abuse, some computer crimes, and those types of things. So I think that these applications are a little more broad than just sexual abuse. And so I really want to try to have an opportunity to educate just people on how the real world works when it comes to these types of destructive interpersonal issues. And I think with a little bit of education, it might help parents, it might help victims, and it might help survivors and just anyone who might be more interested in how to, man, just help people out there generally. So my first presentation, the title I've kind of come up with as this series of discussions is Raising Children in a Me Too World, and It's Always Been a Me Too World. Mm-hmm. Right? And when I talk about raising kids, sometimes I'm talking about raising ourselves when I talk about kids. So my first presentation next Saturday is going to be next Wednesday. Yeah. Thanks, man. The 14th, 6:30 is, how to develop a child's identity to prevent, expose, and heal abuse. And there's some real counterintuitive things that happen, that I think make, children sometimes particularly vulnerable to abuse that we, as just society and as parents and as loved ones, may not be as conscious of. And I'm asked all the time, hey, is there a resource? Is there a book that you can suggest that'll give some techniques? And I really don't, because of a lot of this stuff doesn't seem to be presented in a way that's, I don't know, that's as accessible as maybe it should be. So instead, I'd like to present what I've learned at conferences and trainings and from some of the best professionals throughout the country on some of these issues, and hopefully it'll help other people as well. So mine's not going to be quite as sarcastic maybe as Glenn's presentation.
I thought you were going to say wooey.
Wooey?
Yeah.
I'm sure there will be plenty of woo.
Okay, all right.
It'll be Matt Long woo. But I'm interested to see, if nothing else, I've got to get this out of me, and it can be other people can take and do with it whatever they will. So that's what I want to do on alternating Wednesdays. And I really like the energy of talking to people that aren't just the infants, and I think it could spawn a pretty good discussion. So the way I kind of do things is hopefully going to be less just lecture, but really facilitating a discussion, because as I kind of said, my new philosophy of us all teaching each other from our own life experiences. I don't claim to have all the answers, just most of them. I'm just kidding. I have.
As long as you recognize that's just a claim.
Yes. So, yeah. Yes, just a claim. So, yeah, I'm really excited to kind of have this alternating Wednesday of live infant recording and
Wednesday Night Live.
Wednesday Night Live.
And you know, Scott's not able to be here tonight because it's his birthday. Happy birthday, Scott. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, why did he schedule a birthday for our first Wednesday Night Live thing? But he'll probably be interested in sharing some things every once in a while. And I think the common objective with all of it is to kind of help facilitate healing through education, through humor, you know, laughter, levity, but also like the types of conversations that are interesting to us, interesting to you, that you bring to this. We do want it to be interactive.
Well, we were saying, or I was saying the other day, is the thing that I found most valuable about the podcast over the last 5 years wasn't just exploring these ideas, but was bouncing these ideas off the other guys.
Yeah.
And so much of the growth wasn't, here, let me put out my ideas in the world, but rather to have those ideas kind of challenged and reflected back from people who I love and trust, and in some cases just was frustrated with, but then after the fact realized, oh, that was actually pretty helpful as well. And so I think that's what we want to bring, kind of a little larger or a larger application of other people engage, and maybe rather than just listening to us, may want to be a part of the discussion as well.
What about you guys that are here? What are some of the things that you would like to see or hear from us on these Wednesday nights?
I've got, I just wanted to mention, you guys did the Sunstone presentation Sunday, right, or last week?
Yeah.
And I wasn't actually able to go, but I listened to the recording. And, you know, I've been out probably for a couple of years, and so I feel like I've processed a lot, or I feel like I'm, you know, pretty stable mentally. And something that Scott said really hit me about kind of not, you know, not looking at a common background with people, and not, you know, attaching, hey, we're all going to be tight and have these same views going forward because we have this common background of leaving Mormonism, but rather looking at commonalities going forward. And I at this stage in my life, man, that struck me really, really hard.
Yeah.
And so with you guys doing this, it's very, very, very helpful to hear and to have these conversations in this type of setting. So I just, you know, want to say thank you to doing this.
You're welcome.
Well, yeah, and I think with Jen, I am all over my mouth today. What Glenn was saying earlier about a rejuvenation and kind of a rebirth, I guess, of infants. I think it's about this, of doing something more constructive rather than just breaking down, you know, our past. And
not that we won't still do that.
Sure.
And
still part of us, man.
You know, and the thing, you know, like I agree with what Scott said, and Matt reiterated it, that, you know, when you're trying to build community around something that's in the past, you're going to get stuck in what's in the past. I mean, it's just like, duh. But if you're saying you should just get over that quicker, well, we didn't. We, you know, so that's why I like the way that we framed that Sunstone presentation as advice that we would give to our younger selves. And Colleen mentioned in hers, she's like, I wouldn't have listened to myself anyways because I was too stubborn in it. And I think it takes everybody a different pace, a different time. There is a value in deconstructing these things and understanding the past and how that affected you. But then there's the risk of getting stuck in that and not moving forward. So it's trying to find that balance. And part of, I don't know, the rejuvenation of my enthusiasm for Infants on Thrones is saying I can still do that. I can offer that to people that need to reflect on the past and need to just laugh at the apostles and just like the stupid stuff that happens, and they want to hear smackdowns. I can do that. We recorded a SmackDown the other night. John Hamer and Randy and Bob and myself on McConkie's Seven Deadly Heresies. It took us an hour and a half to get through the first one. So we're going to be doing more of that one. But it was a lot of fun. So we can still do things like that. And the parodies, conference parodies, that sort of thing. But I think a shift for me is that it's like I don't, and maybe I never really did see faith as an enemy, and that's kind of one of the reasons I got labeled the TBN Whisperer. But I think even more so now, I'm kind of seeing the value and reclaiming that faith. And yeah, there's certain things that we know, but that doesn't mean that the things that we can't know, we can't still have some faith in if it's a conscious choice that brings meaning and joy into your life and it's not harming other people, you know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Like there's certain lessons that we've learned. And I also feel really strongly that the tools that we learned in deconstructing our Mormon culture and trying to find ourselves in it as separate from it really need to be applied towards this Western culture that we're living in, that we're being bombarded with all of these messages and these things that we just feel are givens and they're truths and we're hopeless to have any power against it. I think because of the experience that we've had going out of Mormonism, if we understand that better, we'll be better armed to deal with what's ahead of us in the world with all of the revolution that's coming.
You know, I'm also really, really hopeful that this new kind of iteration here of Infants on Thrones also draws a more diverse audience, where it's not just, you know, the either transitioning or, you know, it's not a specific target to just kind of Mormons, but there will be messages and ideas that will kind of resonate to more people and, again, a more diverse, I guess, with more diverse backgrounds and that, because I think there's real value in that. If what I was talking about in at Sunstone about the idea of connections with other people and learning what other people know and getting a greater perspective by seeing what other people's perceptions are, that if we just spend time talking about some of these concepts with people with a similar background, we're limiting ourselves as to some of the growth that we can have. I feel pretty strongly about that, and so you know, hopefully that'll happen. We'll see. It may just end up being the two of us and two other people for, you know, many, many, many weeks. And if that's the case, that's fine too.
Yeah, because what I read tonight, I would have just read alone in my office at home. You know, so I can do that here, and if, you know, you guys want to come and show up, if others want to come and show up, and then we can talk about it afterwards. That's a new dimension for me that I haven't had before, so that's great.
And I'm going to try to do videos. See if we can do YouTube videos now with discussions, but we'll see.
Really?
Yeah.
What's the AV limitations here? Yeah, because they don't really have good internet here, right, to be able to stream stuff?
Yeah, I think we may have to get a hotspot or something, which wouldn't be horrible. We can.
What is this connected to here? Is that?
Yeah, I mean, they've got it, and there's definitely some things.
Maybe we need to get Craig schooled into the audio visual aspects of this, and yeah,
help. I like that Phoenix space a little bit better. It's kind of got a better vibe.
Yeah, it's a nice. Well, this is a really weird picture of
the Kenny Jesus.
It is Kenny Jesus.
Well, it's Kenny Jesus. It's either Kenny Jesus or Jesus Loggins. One of them.
It's Jesus Loggins. It's totally Jesus Loggins.
Right.
Maybe you could shut the curtains.
Highway to.
Maybe you can shut the curtain so he isn't looking at us the whole time.
If we shut the curtain, we'll probably just get like one eye and it'll be even creepier.
Oh yeah, he'll still be able to see.
Yeah. No, that Phoenix location's really nice. I like their stained glass with the little boy and Aslan.
Yes, Aslan. Like, that's right.
I thought that was really cool.
I did. I really liked the space. Moving around there, but this one's a little. This feels a little 1970s cookie cutter Mormon. Pew, it's my issue with it, but
and having said that, we're so grateful to the
horrible. Really are. So I'll tell you, some of the best freaking people I've met our community of Christ.
It's too late.
It's so true. They're so kind and so loving. It's really they're good people. Just an ugly building.
And anything else? We've got time. We don't have to end, but we don't have to stay.
So Wednesday Night Live, I'm thinking we can start doing some music, live music.
Yeah.
We can really make this a party.
That's right.
You want to be like the Wednesday Night Live band, right?
You'd be the early Paul Schaefer.
Paul Schaefer was part of it, yeah. There was the G.E. Smith and the Saturday Night Live. They were the ones that I remember from the late 80s.
G.E. Smith, a guitar dude.
Yeah,
right?
They were like the band for Hall & Oates.
Were they really?
Yeah, they're in the Private Eyes video.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Private Eyes is a song from Hall & Oates in 1988. I don't know.
We're watching you.
We could learn that after the disco song. And
oh, you want to do it after the disco? Yeah, we need to get together and do that.
Play on the organ?
Yeah. We could do Church Lady. Church Lady got me in big trouble in my high school senior year. Did you know about that, Ryan?
No.
You were too young.
Yeah.
I had my microphone privileges suspended.
Right.
At school?
Yeah. So for the homecoming assembly, I thought it would be funny to have the church lady announce the homecoming candidates. And I had a really good friend of mine who I just reconnected with. He lives in Miami now, and he was in advertising. He created the Captain Obvious campaign for that hotel chain. Anyway, he did a really good church lady impression. His name is Graham. And so a couple weeks before the homecoming thing, I said, why don't you do this? Okay, great. Do you want me to help you write anything? No, I'm good. So fine. Get somebody to have a costume. We show up on the day of, and he bails. He's like, yeah, I didn't prepare anything. I'm not going to do anything. And I'm like, what are you talking about? You're scared. You're such a wimp. Fine, I'll do it. Give me your script. I don't have anything. Fine, I'll just wing it. Yeah, that wasn't the best idea. So I ended up insulting all the Mexicans at the school, because church lady would insult Mexicans. And I called one of the teachers satanic, and another couple that I said they were enjoying fornication.
This is Corona.
This is a Corona. Yeah, this is a Corona del Sol. The school colors are orange and yellow. And as one of the cheerleaders is walking out, I said, you know, look at Tracy Jones. School spirit. Orange skin and yellow hair, because she was a fake and bake tan bleach blonde. Anyway, you know, that got the best response. I was quite proud of. But yeah, it's on my Facebook page. It's the video. Have you not seen it?
No.
Yeah. Yeah. My friend's mom was recording it, so I've got a videotape of it, and you can hear when she's going, oh. It's kind of great. So there's that, and then like as soon as I walked off, the vice principal and the student council advisor, they're like, what are you doing? You got to go back out there and apologize. So I went back out there and I apologized. And everybody thought it was a joke. They were just laughing at it. And I'm like, I didn't know what to say, because these homecoming nominees really deserve our respect. And they're just laughing at it. Like, I deeply apologize for this. So, yeah. Yeah, so we could do Church Lady for Wednesday night live.
You got material experience. Go.
Yeah, and if not, I'll just wing it.
Always a good idea.
Yeah. Cool. We can be done.
Good job. Right. Shadow the Lamanite.
Shadow the Lamanite, yeah. In 2 weeks from tonight, we'll start Shadow the Lamanite.
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Glenn from Infants on Thrones, and you'll never believe what happened to me. One night, as I was kneeling down to pray, I bumped my knee on a really hard rock.
Ow!
And when I looked down to get rid of that damn thing, that damn thing was glowing. So I put it down in my crotch and stuffed my face down real close. And holy cow, you guys, you'll never guess all the groovy things I can see now.
I don't care what you say anymore. This is my life. Leave me alone.
on Thrones.
Minisode.
The New Book of Abraham, Infant Styles. First translated from the Papyrus by Joseph Smith, if you can really call it a translation, and then retranslated by Glenn from Infants on Thrones through the Peeping Stone Erastus, which is what I call my Peeping Stone. Seriously, don't ask. Introduction. A translation of some ancient records that have fallen into our hands from the catacombs of Egypt. The real writings of real Abraham while he was really in Egypt. Really written by his own real hand upon real papyrus. I totally promise you guys. So don't tell me that Joseph Smith didn't teach that these Egyptian scrolls were actually written by the actual Abraham. You know, the scrolls that just happened to find their way to Kirtland, Ohio in 1835 and sold to Joseph Smith by Michael Chandler, along with four mummies he was trying to unload that had been excavated from Thebes nearly 30 years earlier. Yeah, that was Abraham, all right. Even if modern Egyptologists claim that the papyri were common funerary texts from a guy named Horus, what did they know? They don't have peeping stones. But then again, neither do most of you. So just listen to what Abraham really actually wrote, okay? And judge for yourself. Because here it is. Chapter heading. Abraham wants it all, and he wants it right now because he's so awesome. He's persecuted for being so awesome. God saves him because he's so awesome. The origins and government of Egypt are reviewed, naturally, as you would expect in a story about Abraham. Chapter 1. Verse 1. Hey everybody, this is Abraham, for real. And I grew up in the Chaldeans, which was a pre-Babylonian empire from about 900 to 400 BC. Pretty impressive, huh? Seeing as how the Bible places me, Abraham, somewhere around 2000 BC. But let's forget all about that for a minute, because the story starts when I was in Chaldea at my dad's house, and I, Abraham, saw it was time to, you know, get out of Dodge. Verse 2. Why? Well, because I was really pretty righteous and awesome and big and important. And because I wanted to be even more bigger and more important with pretty much all the knowledge in the universe. Not like a dweeby, insufferable know-it-all, but more like a cool, hey, I'll use Abraham as my lifeline. No one beats me at Jeopardy kind of know-it-all. And also, this is sort of embarrassing, but I sort of wanted to be a father of many nations because, you know, isn't that what every kid wants? And I also wanted to be a prince of peace. So, because I wanted all these things, I asked if I could just get ordained to the high priesthood, because that's pretty much what priesthood does for you. Sorry, ladies. Verse 3. But this whole priesthood thing was passed down from the fathers. It came down from the fathers, from the beginning of time. I mean, even from the beginning, from the foundations of the earth, down to the present time. Even the right of the firstborn, or the first man, who was Adam, or the first father, through all of the fathers, unto me, from the beginning. You know, like I said before, and from the fathers. So let's not forget that. Do I need to say it again? Verse 4. So, like I was saying, I went and asked for my appointment unto the priesthood according to the appointment of God unto the fathers concerning, you know, the seed. Verse 5. But look, everyone, my jerk-faced fathers had turned from righteousness a long time ago. I should have known that before I asked, right? But they turned from the holy commandments which the Lord their God had given unto them, and now they worship the freaking gods of the heathen. So they utterly refused to hearken to my voice. Maybe I should have seen it coming. Verse 6. Because, you know, their hearts were set to do evil and were wholly turned to the false god of Elkanah and the false god of Libnah and the false god of Mamakra and the false god of Koresh. And if you don't believe me that those are really false gods, look it up. Those names don't exist anywhere in history. Just here in this cute little story written by me, the real Abraham. But those false gods, they aren't real because, you know, they never were. That's part of what makes them so false. But if you look at the picture illustrating this story that I'm going to put in this book here, you'll see the God-worshipping jars under the altar that I'm about to be sacrificed on. But, oh, dang it, I'm giving it all away. Verse 7. Because look, my jerk-faced fathers had turned their hearts to bloody human sacrifice. No, wait. Bloody virgin sacrifice. Yeah, that's it. And they liked it because, you know, what jerk-faced, unrighteous followers of false gods wouldn't? So they hearkened not unto my voice, but endeavored to take away my life by the hand of the priest of Elkanah. And dude, look, it gets even deeper, because the Chaldean priest of Elkanah was also the Egyptian priest of Pharaoh. I don't know how, he just was honest. Verse 8. Now, they really liked human sacrifice, because I'm telling you, man, they were pretty freaking wicked. Verse 9. And it came to pass that the priest made an offering unto the god of Pharaoh, and also unto the god of Shagreel, even after the manner of the Egyptians. Now, the god of Shagreel was the sun, not Ra, like you've probably heard other places. Shagreel. Trust me on that. Verse 10. Even the thank offering of a child did the priest of Pharaoh offer upon the altar, which stood by the hill called Potiphar's Hill, at the head of the plain of Olishem, just down the street from Saruman's Bakery at the corner of Highlander Street and Vine. Verse 11. Now, this priest had offered upon his altar three virgins at one time. Three! Who were the daughters of Oneida, one of the royal descent directly from the loins of Ham. Yeah, I said loins. And these virgins were offered up because of their virtue, because they would not bow down to suck on to worship the gods of wood or of stone. Therefore, they were killed upon this altar, and it was done after the manner of the Egyptians, like I said before, because, you know, the Egyptians were all about human sacrifice. I mean, by your day, you'll see all that strewn all about the archaeological records. Ask anyone. Verse 12. And it came to pass that the priests laid violence upon me, and that they might also slay me, as they did those other virgins upon this altar. I told you I was totally righteous, right? And that you may also have knowledge of this altar, I will refer you to the representation at the commencement of this record. Because, man, I freaking love me some picture books. All us papyri-writing 2000 BC prophet guys do. It's an Egyptian thing, y'all. And it's not as easy as it looks. I can't wait till someone reforms this Egyptian thing. Verse 13. Anyway, this terrible altar was made in the form of a bedstead, such as was had among the Chaldeans. And it stood before those false gods of Elkanah and Libna and Machmachra and Koresh, and also a god like unto that of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. No, those aren't canopic jars. Well, at least not in my day. Who knows what your so-called experts call them now? Verse 14. And so that you can have more of a false understanding of these false gods, I've gone ahead and drawn up the fashion of them in the figures that you're going to see at the beginning, which manner of figures is called by the Chaldeans Ralinos, which signifies hieroglyphics, and are usually drawn in the morning around breakfast time. And interesting side note, Chaldeans who draw Ralinos are called Carolinos, or sometimes Kyrios for short. And that's where the name of that Cheerios breakfast cereal came from. Verse 15. And as they lifted up their hand upon me, that they might take away my life, behold, I lifted up my voice unto the Lord my God, and the Lord hearkened and heard me, because I was way more awesome and big and important than those three virgins I told you about before, who also lifted up their voices. But come on, God can't save everyone, right? And he filled me with the vision of the Almighty, and the angel of his presence stood by me and immediately unloosed my bands like Houdini, and I was free. Verse 16. And his voice was unto me, Abraham, Abraham, behold, my name is Jehovah. Nice to meet you. And I've heard thee, and I've come down to deliver thee, and to take thee away from thy father's house and from all thy kinsfolk into a strange land, which thou knowest not of. Because, look, Abraham, this is what I want everyone around you to know. And you're going to be a prophet, so I want you to tell them all this. Okay? The people I love best, the people that follow me, well, I'll always ask them to move around, you know? Whether it's from some place in the distant future like New York or Pennsylvania to a place like, I don't know, Kirtland, Ohio or something. If you guys flee the place of your fathers and move into a new place to start a new religion, well, that's sort of a pretty decent indication that I'm in your corner. So just let everybody know that, okay, Abraham? Would you do that for me, please? Because I'm sort of busy.
Verse 17.
Busy at being pissed at all the wicked people who turn away from me and turn their hearts to worship false gods like Elkanah or Libna or Obama. Therefore, I have come down to visit them and to destroy them who have lifted up his hand against thee, Abraham, my son, to take away thy life.
Verse 18.
Behold, I will lead thee by my hand, and I will take thee to put upon thee my name, even the priesthood of thy father, which my power shall be over thee.
Verse 19.
As it was with Noah, so shall it be with thee. But through thy ministry, my name shall be known in the earth forever, for I am thy God. Over and out.
Verse 20.
Behold, Potiphar's hill was in the land of Ur of the Chaldea, like I said before, and the Lord broke down the altar of Elkanah and the gods of the land and utterly destroyed them and smote the priest that he died, just like that. And there was a great mourning in Chaldea and also thousands of miles away in the court of Pharaoh, which Pharaoh signifies king by royal blood, which may seem like an abrupt and awkward transition to go from ancient Babylon all the way over to Egypt, but I've got to make a connection between Abraham and Egyptian stuff somehow. And besides, I've got some super interesting and totally profound things that God wants me to tell you all, okay?
Verse 21.
Like that this king of Egypt was a descendant from the loins of Ham and was a partaker of the blood of the Canaanites by birth. You know, black people. A partaker of the blood of black people.
Verse 22.
From this descent sprang all the Egyptians, and thus the black blood of the black Canaanites was preserved in the land.
Verse 23.
And I swear, you guys, this isn't racist or sexist at all, but the original land of Egypt was originally founded by a woman, by a black woman, who was the daughter of Ham and the daughter of Egyptus, which in the Chaldean signifies Egypt, which signifies that which is forbidden. Did you guys know that? That Egypt means forbidden? And I'll tell you why, but first let's hear more about this woman who discovered a forbidden land.
Verse 24.
When this woman discovered the land, it was underwater, who afterwards settled her sons on it. And thus, from Ham sprang that race which preserved the curse in the land. You know, the darkies again. And here's where it gets all forbidden and stuff.
Verse 25.
Because the first government of Egypt was established by Pharaoh, the eldest son of Egyptus, the daughter of Ham. And look, I'll be honest with you. I don't know if this means that Ham fathered children with his own daughter named Egyptus. I honestly wouldn't put it past him. Or if Ham had a wife and a daughter, both named Egyptus, or what. Maybe it was just a really popular name that year. But either way, they were no good. I'm telling you that because they set up this government after the manner of Ham, which copied the patriarchal order of things when it wasn't supposed to copy the patriarchal order of things, right?
Verse 26.
Because Pharaoh, well, he was sort of an okay guy in the beginning, and he established his kingdom and judged his people wisely and justly all his days, seeking earnestly to imitate that order established by the fathers in the first generations, in the days of the first patriarchal reign, even the reign of Adam, and also of Noah, his father, who blessed him with the blessings of the earth and with the blessings of wisdom, but cursed him as pertaining to the priesthood.
Verse 27.
Now Pharaoh, being of that lineage by which he could not have the right of the priesthood, you know, at least not until some future 1978 date when it will be okay for them to have it. But notwithstanding, the pharaohs would fain claim it from Noah through Ham, wherefore my very own father, thousands of miles away in Chaldea, was led away by their idolatry, which may not seem to make a lot of sense to you, but trust me, it does. And if you say it doesn't, then you're the worst kind of person there could possibly be.
Verse 28.
Now you know me, the big and important, awesome Abraham. So, nice to meet you. And now what I want to do is pretty much tell you everything that happened from the beginning of time until right now, in my real day, as I really sit with my real hand and really write this on real papyri, because I have the records that other big and important people wrote before me. Because it's all about records and continuing the story, right? So that's what I'm going to do.
Verse 29.
Now, after the priest of Elkanah was smitten that he died, there came a fulfillment of those things which were said unto me concerning the land of Chaldea, that there should be a famine in the land. And I mean, I know I didn't tell you before that this had been a prophecy and it was fulfilled, but it was, and trust me, it really was fulfilled. Verse 30. So, because of this famine, my father was sorely tormented, and guess what? He repented of the evil which he had determined against me to take away my life. Isn't that cool? Verse 31. But the records of the fathers, even the patriarchs concerning the right of the priesthood, well, the Lord my God preserved that in my own hands, not my dad's. Because even though he repented, he still wasn't anywhere near as big or important as I was. So that's how a knowledge of the beginning of the creation came to me. But not only that, I'm also going to tell you about the planets and the stars, and that's some really cool stuff that you're not going to want to miss. So stay tuned, because this stuff is about to get really real, for real.
Feel it, and you'll know it's all true. You'll just feel it. You'll be a Mormon. By gosh, a Mormon. Just believe.
A Mormon.
Oh, I believe. I
believe. Hi, this is Sarah from Colorado Springs, Colorado, and I am an English girl hopelessly lost in a conservative American world. You can comment on this episode on the website infantsonthrones.com, and if you really like what you hear, give the Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes. I did. Anyone for the closing prayer?
I'll bet you really can't wait for chapter 2. Well, you're going to have to.
Thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones.
Hi, my name is Glenn from Infants on Thrones, and you'll never believe what happened to me. One night, as I was kneeling down to pray, I bumped my knee on a really hard rock. And when I looked down to get rid of that damn thing, that damn thing was glowing. So I put it down in my crotch and stuffed my face down real close. And holy cow, you guys, you'll never guess all the groovy things I can see now.
I don't care what you say anymore. This is my life. Go ahead with your own life. Leave me alone.
This is Infants on Thrones.
Minnesota.
The New Book of Abraham, Infant Styles, Chapter 2. Hey everybody, remember me? It's the writings of the real Abraham, as revealed to me through my real peepstone, Erastus. And it's finally time to continue our story with Chapter 2. But first, let's recap Chapter 1, shall we? Chapter 1, The Real Writings of Real Abraham While He Was Really in Egypt, really written by his own real hand upon real papyrus. He was born and raised in Ur of the Chaldees, thousands of miles and thousands of years away from Pharaoh in Egypt, and yet they still somehow had the same religion and the same priests and the same gods, even the made-up ones. Abraham was good. Everyone else was bad. They tried to sacrifice him, but God stepped in and saved him. And now for the rest of the story. Chapter 2. Gotta be honest, this chapter is sort of boring. It's where the real Abraham, me, leaves Ur to go to the sort of racist black land of the black Canaanites. But Jehovah appears to me at Haran, and all gospel blessings are promised to me and to you guys reading this. You who are me, my, the real Abraham's, real literal blood seed. And through you guys, my real literal blood seed, God's blessings can go forward to everyone. Because trust me, you don't want all those blessings just directly from God. He's super intense, so I'll take the brunt of that for you. So in this sort of boring chapter, I'm going to hit all the major tourist spots through Canaan and other places on the way to Egypt, and I'll snap a few more facsimile photos for you guys, which, I don't know, maybe I'll include for you to look at. And then I'm going to move on to Egypt so that I can write this papyri and have it be discovered by tomb raiders sometime in the distant future and delivered across two continents and an ocean that I'm pretty sure is out there to this awesome dude, Joseph Smith, in Kirtland, Ohio, USA, aka Promised Land, the sequel, part one. And this Joseph guy is probably the only person ever born throughout time on this earth who's more bigger and more better than me, and better at just about almost everything. So this record will be given to him by a traveling salesman so that he can translate it into English, so that you guys, my literal seed, can all feel pretty big and important too. And if you think this brief summary is long and boring, just wait for the next 25 verses, which really don't add much to my story but filler. And, oh yeah, I really want to drill in how important God says that we all are. That's going to be pretty huge as we go forward. So, here we go. You're the best around. Nothing's gonna ever keep you down. You're the best around. Verse 1. Now the Lord my God, not to be confused with the Lord Vader, or the Lord Voldemort, or Little Lord Fauntleroy, or any other Lord for that matter, the God one. Well, he caused, in his great, meek, and loving fury, a terribly benevolent famine to wax sore in the land of Ur. And if you thought Brazilian wax was painful, man, sore famine waxing is even worse. And my brother died. Did I tell you that I had a brother? His name was Haran. Which sort of explains why the land of Haran is called Haran today, which maybe you didn't know already from that other history written about me in that other book of so-called biblical scripture called the Bible, which I have on pretty good authority you guys will probably already have in your day, but will only be as true as it's translated correctly and can never even be as remotely close to true as this account that I'm writing right now with my own hand is. But yeah, my brother died. Verse 2. And it came to pass that I, the real Abraham, took the real Sarai to wife. And by took, I mean we had sex. A lot of sex. Really fantastic desert sex. And I don't mean to brag or anything, but, well, I'm going to let you lady readers out there in on a little secret. Prophets of God make the best lovers. So, you know, ladies, if the opportunity ever arises, I'm just saying. And oh yeah, Nahor, my other brother, who hadn't died yet, took Milcah to wife, who was the daughter of Haran, which means he married his niece, which may sound a little weird to you guys, but look, she was almost 15, so it's all good. Keep that in mind too. Verse 3. Now the Lord had said unto me,
Abraham, get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto a land that I will show thee.
Seriously, he actually said that, for real. That's just how he talks. Weird, right?
Verse 4.
Therefore I left the land of Ur, of the white and delightsome Chaldees, to go into the land of black and not so delightsome Canaan. And I took Lot, my brother's son, and his wife, and Sarai, my wife, and also my father followed after me unto the land which I already told you that we called Haran. And look, I know this isn't all that exciting, but sometimes you just gotta do what God says you gotta do just because he tells you to. Even the boring stuff, like home teaching and collecting fast offerings, just do it.
Verse 5.
And the famine abated, which pretty much means that it sort of ended. And my father tarried in Haran, because tarrying is sort of what my father liked to do. And he dwelt there, because there were many flocks in Haran. And I probably shouldn't tell you this, but my wicked dad had a thing for sheep. Which is what happens when you're wicked, and it all starts by redefining marriage.
Verse 6.
But I, Abraham, and Lot, my brother's son, like I told you before, prayed unto the Lord by kneeling down and closing our eyes and opening the right way and first saying the things that we were thankful for and then asking for all the stuff that we wanted and then closing it in the right way, because God won't really listen any other way. And the Lord appeared unto me, and he said unto me,
Arise and take Lot with thee, He's thy brother's son, remember? Because look, I have purposed to take thee away out of Haran, and to make of thee a minister to bear my name in a strange land, which, get this, I will totally just give to you and to thy seed after thee for an everlasting possession. I said everlasting. It's yours, man, by divine right, as long as you and your seed always hearken to my voice. And, well, I might as well tell you, I tried getting the people who live there already to hearken to my voice, but they think hearkening is for babies, so I'm not going to choose them. And also because they're black.
Verse 7.
For I am the Lord thy God. I dwell in heaven. The earth is my footstool. I stretch my hand out over the sea, and it obeys my voice. I cause the wind and the fire to be my chariot. I say to the mountains, depart hence. And behold, they're taken away by a whirlwind in an instant, suddenly. Really, it's super important to me that you don't confuse me with any of those other lords that aren't quite as powerful as I am.
Verse 8.
And I may as well tell you, my name is Jehovah. Nice to meet you. And I know the end from the beginning. Therefore, my hand shall be over thee. I don't really know what my omniscience has to do with my hand being over you forever, but it sounds all biblical and stuff, so just go with it.
Verse 9.
And I'm also super excited to make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee above measure. Strike that, above measure, above everyone and everything else, and make thy name great among all nations, and thou shalt be a blessing unto thy seed after thee, and in their hands shall they bear this ministry and priesthood unto all nations, who, don't forget, are way less awesome than you, and way less awesome than your big and important seed, who I bet are probably reading this right now, and feeling all warm and special because of this affirmation of their incredible specialness.
Verse 10.
And I will bless them through thy name. For as many as receive this gospel shall be called after thy name, and shall be accounted thy seed, even if they aren't exactly the direct literal blood descendants, like I made a point of highlighting earlier. Even the adopted ones will rise up and bless thee as their father.
Verse 11.
And I will bless them that bless thee, and curse them that curse thee, and give candy to those who give candy to me, and give Indian birds and noogies to those who give Indian birds and noogies to me, and in thee, that is, in thy priesthood, and in thy seed, that is, in thy priesthood, I will give unto thee a promise that this right shall continue in thee, and in thy seed after thee, that is to say, the literal seed, or the seed of the body, even though I just said that it doesn't really matter all that much because of the whole adoption thing. But through you shall all the families of the earth be blessed, even with the blessings of the gospel, which are the blessings of salvation, even of life eternal, which only comes through the priesthood, which only you and your seed will hold, which is pretty much what makes you all so great, or at least the men of your seed, and the women too, I guess, through the men. Did you get all that? Because I am out of here.
Verse 12. Now after the Lord had withdrawn from speaking to me and withdrawn his face from my face, yeah, I actually saw his face, y'all. Did I tell you that he has a face and beautiful eyes and a beard and pretty decent breath? After he took off, I said in my heart, thy servant has sought thee earnestly. Now I have found thee.
Verse 13.
Thou didst send thine angel to deliver me from the God of Elkanah, like I talked about in chapter 1. So since you did that, I guess I'll go ahead and hearken unto thy voice, because I love hearkening. It's my favorite. Therefore, let thy servant, me, the real Abraham, rise up and depart in peace.
Verse 14.
So I, the real Abraham, rose up and departed in peace, as the Lord said unto me, and Lot with me, the son of my brother, remember. And I, the real Abraham, was really 62 years old when I departed out of Haran. Just for those of you keeping track at home.
Verse 15.
And I took Sarai, whom I took to wife when I was in Ur and Chaldee, and Lot, my brother's son, and all our substance that we had gathered, and the souls that we had won in Haran. Not their bodies, just their souls. Don't ask how that happened. And came forth in the way to the land of Canaan. and dwelt in tents as we came on our way. And no, Randy, I don't mean anything sexual by that just because I said the word tent. Don't even ask me if we had camels.
Verse 16.
Therefore, eternity was our covering and our rock and our salvation as we journeyed from Haran by the way of Jershon to come to the land of Canaan. Don't ask me what I mean by that. I just think it sounds pretty neat.
Verse 17.
Now I, the real Abraham, built a real altar in the land of Jershon, and I made a real offering unto the real Lord, and prayed that the famine might be turned away from my father's house, that they might not perish. And since I already told you in verse 5 that the famine had abated, I was pretty confident that this prayer to make the abated famine end would be pretty easy for God to do.
Verse 18.
And then we passed from Jershon through the land unto the place of Shechem. It was situated in the plains of Moreh, and we had already come into the borders of the land of the Canaanites, and I offered sacrifice there in the plains of Moreh too, and called on the Lord devoutly, because we'd come into the land of this idolatrous nation through all these other lands. And trust me, there's a good reason why I'm spelling all this out in so much detail.
Verse 19.
Because this is where the Lord appeared to me again in answer to those other prayers. And he said unto me,
remember when I said I'd give you a land? Well, look around. This is it. Take it. It's yours, baby.
Verse 20.
And I, Abraham, arose from the place of the altar which I had built unto the Lord, and removed from thence unto a mountain on the east of Bethel, and pitched my tent there. Randy, stop snickering. With Bethel on the west and High on the east. And there I built another altar unto the Lord and called again upon the name of the Lord. Because, I don't know, I just sort of love building altars and calling to the Lord. Keep in mind, this was before iPhones.
Verse 21.
And I, the real Abraham, journeyed, going on still towards the south. And there was a continuation of famine in the land, which I don't really get it, because, you know, it had abated, and I prayed to God to keep it abated, and he told me how much he really liked me, and how the things I did for him he would do unto me, and I was all like, dude, Lord, what about all these altars and prayers I keep doing for you? I mean, that's sort of the opposite of giving you a famine, right? So what's the deal? But he didn't appear to me this time, so I, the real Abraham, concluded to go down to Egypt, to sojourn there, for the famine became very grievous, which, in hindsight, is probably why God kept the famine in the first place, to get me to go to Egypt, because I probably wouldn't have gone if he had just told me to go, even though I've pretty much done everything he's told me to do so far, even without being forced to do it by a famine. But wait a minute, what?
Verse 22.
And it came to pass that anyway, when I was come near unto Egypt, the Lord said unto me,
behold, Sarai, thy wife, is a stone-cold fox, and a very fair woman to look upon. Trust me, I'm omniscient. I've seen them all. Seriously, what a bod. Zowie.
Verse 23.
Therefore, it shall come to pass when the Egyptians shall see her, they'll be like all, dude, look at his hot wife. Let's kill him so she'll be single. Then maybe we got a shot. And then they will. They'll just kill you so she'll be single. So maybe they'll have a shot. Therefore, look, see that you do on this wise.
Verse 24.
Let her say unto the Egyptians that she is thy sister, and thy soul shall live. Because look, I'm just going to go ahead and wait for a couple thousand years for one of your seed, a super righteous dude named Moses, who we'll talk about later, to give all these commandments about not lying and stuff. But even then, we'll make it sort of a case-by-case commandment for the most righteous and chosen and big of important of my chosen peoples. Because, I don't know, sometimes I might want you guys to lie.
Verse 25.
And it came to pass that I, Abraham, told Sarai, my wife, all that the Lord had said unto me. Therefore, say unto them, I pray thee, thou art my sister, that it may be well for me for thy sake, and my soul shall live because of thee. And I know that I'm going to leave you all kind of hanging right now, wondering what's going to happen next, but my hands got a little sore from all this writing, so I'm just going to go ahead and end it here, because, I mean, it's sort of obvious that I survived, right? Or else, who would be writing this whole story here?
that Joseph Smith guy? Come on, I mean, he only had like a second grade education. He's totally illiterate. He couldn't write anything like this. I mean, look at what this is. So we'll come back to the story in chapter 3 another time. Later.
Hi, this is Debbie from South Jordan, Utah. I've listened to Infants on Thrones since the first episode, mostly to hear Glenn.
Yeah.
I'm a true fan. Mm-hmm. I enjoy his quick wit, kind heart, and brilliant mind. Yeah. And that I haven't had to change his diapers for a very long time.
Despite all the shit.
My lived experience?
Yeah.
I'm his mom. You can comment on this episode on the website, infantsonthrones.com. And if you really like what you hear, give the Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes. I did.
Did you really?
Anyone for the closing prayer?
But did you really, though?
Not yet, but I will before.
Oh, come on.
Hi, my name is Glenn from Infants on Thrones, and you'll never believe what happened to me. One night, as I was kneeling down to pray, I bumped my knee on a really hard rock. And when I looked down to get rid of that damn thing, that damn thing was glowing. So I put it down in my crotch and stuffed my face down real close. And holy cow, you guys, you'll never guess all the groovy things I can see now.
I don't care what you say anymore. This is my life. Go ahead with your own life. Leave me alone.
This is Infants on Thrones.
Minnesota.
The New Book of Abraham, Infant Styles, Chapter 3. Hey everybody, remember me? It's the writings of the real prophet Abraham as revealed to me through my very own personal peepstone, Erastus. It may be chocolate swirled looking, but it tastes like suppository. Anyway, sorry that it's been so long since releasing Chapter 1 and Chapter 2, but you know, Kolob time. Oh wait, you don't know Kolob time yet, do you? But guess what? You soon will, so without any further ado... You know, there's no other kind of ado. It's always further ado. Wait, could it be something else without any... Closer, I did like further, farther, closer, ado. Anyway, okay, sorry, I guess I put some ado in there. Now let's get to chapter 3.
Chapter 3.
And now for the really good stuff, where I, the real Abraham, learn about the sun, moon, and stars by means of the Urim and Thummim. Because obviously the sun and stars are completely different things, right? You know, okay, anyway, the Lord reveals to me the eternal nature of spirits. I learn of pre-earth life and foreordination, the creation, the choosing of a redeemer, the second state of man, ways to justify racism and any form of xenophobic elitism. So man, I'm starting to really kind of chub up here. So let's just skip the foreplay already and just dive into this thing.
Verse 1.
And I, the real Abraham, had the Urim and Thummim, which the Lord my God had given unto me in Ur of the Chaldees. And they were glowing rocks that I could peep into, right, with my eyes, and they would show me things. And any similarity that this has to that Joseph Smith guy who's going to be born over 2,000 years from now on a whole nother side of the world, that guy with his peepstones who's going to, you know, discover and translate what I'm writing right now so that the whole wide world can know the truth that the devil just keeps trying to cover up from him? Well, anyway, any similarity between my Urim and Thummim and Joseph's peepstones is either entirely inconsequential or it's an indication that God works through past and present prophets in similar ways. Because, come on, that's like over 2,000 years from right now when I, the real Abraham, am actually sitting down and writing this on this weather-retardant ink and papyri. And no, retardant is not a bad word.
Verse 2.
And I saw the stars twinkling up there, all pretty and everything. And I saw that they were very great, and that one of them was nearest unto the throne of God. And there were many great ones which were near unto it, like pretty big, amazing, twinkling great stars.
Verse 3.
And the Lord said unto me, these are the governing ones, and the name of the great one is Kolob. because it's near unto me. And Kolob in the Adamic tongue actually means close to me, which explains why one of the first games that Adam and Eve played in the Garden of Eden was Marco, Kolob, Marco, Kolob. I don't know, maybe you had to be there. It was super fun. But look, I am the Lord thy God, and I have set this one awesome star to govern all those things which belong to the same order as that earth upon which thou standest. That's what God said to me, the real Abraham.
Verse 4.
And the Lord said directly unto me, indirectly through the Urim and Thummim, that Kolob was after the manner of the Lord, according to its times and seasons, in the revolutions thereof. And one revolution was a day unto the Lord after his manner of reckoning, it being 1,000 years according to the time appointed unto that whereon thou standest, us. This is the reckoning of the Lord's time, according to the reckoning of Kolob. Which, you know, is probably why people think that God doesn't listen to their prayers and stuff, because they're all like, God, can you please help me with this job interview I have tomorrow? I'll even fast to make sure that you want to help me out even more, because I know that me going without food somehow makes it more likely that you're going to actually do something this time. So please, I know that agency is really cool and important and all, but could you please make the people that I'm interviewing with totally think that I'm awesome and that they need to hire me and pay me top dollar? Please, God, please will you do this for me? I'll fast. Amen. And then they goest into their interview and they gettest not the job. And then they're all, what's up, Lord? Didn't I do it right? Fine, I'm going to leave the Mormon church and just go out and sin. And then God's all, hang on, dude. It may have been a few days for you, but I go by the reckoning of Kolob. But that was only like 0.057 nanoseconds for me, and I was in the middle of taking a leak. Plus, I have like 25 billion other people asking me to find their car keys and other things like that. So can I just get a minute to breathe here? Sheesh, where is your Nalum Bagalum?
Nalum Bagalum.
Verse 5.
And the Lord said unto me, the real Abraham, the planet which is the lesser light, and by planet I mean the moon that you see in the sky, well, I created that to give lesser light to the earth, even though it doesn't really technically give light per se. You know, even I, the Lord, sometimes play games with smoke and mirrors, sometimes. But yeah, that planet that's not a planet is to rule the night, while the sun is meant to rule the day in the heavenly hierarchical order of things. So think of it this way. The earth right now is under your feet, right, real Abraham, right? And the moon is above your head, right? But the sun is also above your head. And just as the moon rules over the earth by night, the sun rules over the earth by day. And it's a greater ruling because the light is brighter and the sun is bigger and it's farther away. And that's sort of what I'm getting at. There's always a bigger, badder fish out there. And there's always a bigger, badder sun that rules over your sun, and a bigger, badder sun that rules over that sun, and onward and upward, all the way up to Kolob, which is the biggest and baddest of them all. You really have no way of conceiving just how big and bad it really is. But okay, I'm getting a little ahead of myself. It's exciting stuff.
Verse 6.
And the Lord said unto me, now, real Abraham, these two facts exist. And I thought for a moment that God was stifling a smile when he said the word facts. For behold, thine eyes see it. It is given unto thee to know the times of reckoning and the set time, yea, the set time of the earth upon which thou standest, and the set time of the greater light, which is set to rule the day, and the set time of the lesser light, which is set to rule the night.
Verse 7.
Now, real Abraham, here, smoke this. It will help everything seem to make a little bit more sense than I'm going to say here, okay? All right, okay. Now, the set time of the lesser light is a longer time as to its reckoning than the reckoning of the time of the earth upon which thou standest.
Than the reckoning of the time of the earth upon which thou standest.
Verse 8. And where these two facts exist, there shall be another fact above them. That is, there shall be another planet whose reckoning of time shall be longer still.
Number 9.
Number 9.
And thus, there shall be the reckoning of the time of one planet above another, until thou come nigh unto Kolob, which Kolob is after the reckoning of the Lord's time, which Kolob is set nigh unto the throne of God, to govern all those planets which belong to the same order as that upon which thou standest. Whoa.
Verse 10.
And it is given unto thee to know the set time of all the stars that are set to give light until thou come near unto the throne of God. Because, you see, it's all about time. It's all about how long it takes for a planet to spin on its axis and make a rotation, and then also how long it takes it to complete a full orbit around its sun, because, you know, that's what solar governing, universal cosmic governing means. It just makes sense, right? That answers everything, doesn't it? Isn't it about time?
Isn't it about time? From the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
It's about time, it's about space, about strange people in the strangest place.
Verse 11. Thus, I, the real Abraham, talked and toked with the Lord face to face, as one man talketh and toketh with another. And he told me of the works which his hand had made, and I was like, whoa.
Verse 12.
And he said unto me, my son, and his hand was stretched out. Behold, I will show you all these. And he put his hand upon mine eyes, which totally makes sense, right? Because if you're going to show something to someone, the first thing you do is cover up their eyes, right? To maybe make it more of an exciting surprise or something when you lead them to what you're going to show them, and then you lift your hand. I don't know. But, okay, so anyway, even though his hand was covering my eyes, I somehow saw those things which his hands had made, which were many, and they multiplied before mine eyes, and I could not see the end thereof. It was like a kaleidoscope of horny, polygamous, fluffy bunnies morphing and growing and expanding in patterns and colors. And wow, spirituality is deep, man. It is deep.
Yeah, verse 13.
And he pointed to the sun in the sky, and he said unto me, this is Shinehan,
shiny, happy people,
which is the sun. Duh. And he said unto me, Kokob, which is a star.
Rise and buy the world a
Kokob.
Not Kolob, the star, the bestest star, but Kokob, K-O-K-O-B, generic name for a single star. And he didn't show me all the rest. I didn't see Komob and Konob and Kopob and onwards, but I'm pretty sure that they exist somewhere.
Taking away the moments that make up the dull days.
And then he pointed to the sky again, and he said unto me, Olea, which means the moon. Probably because going out into the fields at night under the moonlight is one of the best places to get oleid. And he said unto me, Kokobom, Kokaobom, which I can't even pronounce, and signifies stars, plural stars, or all the great lights which were seen in the firmament of heaven, which is different from Kokob, which is a single star, you see. Kokobom, Kokobim, Kokobom is the plural, with all those sparkling bombs of light, you see? And why there isn't a Kokobim coffee house somewhere in Salt Lake City right now to this day, even the Lord doesn't quite know. Maybe I, the real Abraham, should actually trademark that bad boy right now.
Verse 14.
And, oh yeah, it was in the nighttime when the Lord spake these words unto me, which explains why I was able to see the lights in the night sky for those discerning listeners of you who are just out to question everything that I say. Good for you, because I've got the answers. And as I looked out, the Lord said, I will multiply thee, thou most realest of Abrahams, and thy seed after thee, like unto these Kokobom, and if thou canst count the number of sands, so shall be the number of thy seeds. And when thou canst snatch this pebble from mine hand, it shalt be time for you to leave.
Verse 15.
And the Lord said unto me, hey, real Abraham, I show these things unto thee before thou goest into Egypt, that ye may declare all these words unto the Egyptians. So basically, I'm saying the Egyptian mythology all started when Abraham come to town. You go, real Abraham.
Verse 16.
So here's some more facts. If two things exist, and there be one above the other, there shall be still yet greater things above them. Therefore, Kolob is the greatest of all the cocoa bomb that thou hast seen, because it's nearest unto me. And I, of course, am greater than you, but there's a chain. And I, the Lord thy God, is at the top of the chain, and my servants, the prophets, are, you know, right there with me. And then the rest of y'all are way down at the bottom of that chain. So, you know, just remember who you are and where you fit on the hierarchical chain. It's kind of like Kolob, okay?
Verse 17.
Now, if there be two things, one above the other, and the moon be above the earth, then it may be that a planet or a star may exist above it. And there is nothing that the Lord thy God shall take in his heart to do, but that he will do it. Because what I just said makes total sense, right? And, okay, here, have another one of these. Hold it. Hold it. Hold it. Okay, let me say it again. Now, if there be two things, one above the other, and the moon be above the earth, then it may be that a planet or a star may exist above it. And there is nothing that the Lord thy God should take in his heart to do, but that he will do it. Well, I totally know Kung Fu. Verse 18. How be it that he made the greater star, as also if there be two spirits, and one shall be more intelligent than the other, yet these two spirits, notwithstanding one is more intelligent than the other, have no beginning. They existed before. They shall have no end. They shall exist after, for they are Nolam. G-N-O-L-A-U-M. Nolam, or eternal. I forgot to tell you that Nolam means eternal, right? Well, it does. And interestingly enough, Begalam is God's word for perspective. So, you know, just keep all of this in Nolam Begalam. That is so stupid.
Verse 19.
And the Lord said unto me, these two facts, oh, the sense of humor of our God, do exist. That if there are two spirits, one being more intelligent than the other, there shall be another more intelligent than they. I am the Lord thy God. I am more intelligent than they all.
Take that.
Verse 20. The Lord thy God sent his angel to deliver thee, real Abraham, from the real hands of the real priest of Elkanah, that false god who was so false that he never actually existed anywhere at any point in recorded history, just here in this papyri written by the real hand of the real Abraham.
Verse 21.
I, the Lord thy God, dwell in the midst of all them, all false and fictitious gods. I now, therefore, have come down unto thee to declare unto thee the works which my real hands have really made, wherein my wisdom excelleth them all. For I rule in the heavens above and in the earth beneath, in all wisdom and prudence, over all the intelligences thine eyes have seen from the beginning. I came down in the beginning in the midst of all the intelligences thou hast seen.
Verse 22.
Now the Lord had shown unto me, the real Abraham, the intelligences that were organized before the world was. And among all these, there were many of the noble and great ones, especially those really noble and great ones reserved for the last days to restore God's true truth onto the earth once again. So if you're hearing this and you're a member of the Mormon Church, just keep in mind, you're one of those special noble and great ones, okay? Just remember how special you are, okay? Okay.
Verse 23.
And God saw all these intelligence soul thingies that they were good. And he stood in the midst of them and he said, these will I make my rulers. For he stood among those that were spirits, and he saw that they were good, like I said before, you know. But since papyri is so much easier to write on than carving reformed Egyptian into gold plates, why not be a little redundant in the things that we say every now and then? And God said unto me, Abraham, thou art one of them great and noble ones. Thou wast chosen before thou wast born. So rockest thou on with thy bad self. And I did, but not to the point of masturbation, because Moses was the guy with the burning bush. That doesn't make any sense.
Verse 24.
And there stood one among them that was like unto God. And he said unto those who were with him, we will go down, for there is space there. And we will take of these materials, which includes all these old dinosaur bones from other planets. And we will make an earth whereon these may dwell, and insert all these fake fossils just to mess with them, just to see if they will believe the things that they read in scriptures, because, well, just because that's the way to be good. Or will they only believe things that can be tested and proven, and reject those things that have been tested and disproven? Like the wise man who built his house upon a rock. But wait a minute. Never mind.
Verse 25.
But God looked around and said, we will prove them herewith, to see if they will do all things whatsoever the Lord their God, or his authorized prophets on this earth, shall command them. And I mean all things, like the whole deal, not just part of it. All of it. The alpha and omega of things. The front and the behind. For reals. All things, dude. All.
Verse 26.
And those who keep their first estate shall be added upon. And they who keep not their first estate shall have not glory in the same kingdom with those who keep their first estate. It just can't happen. You cannot mix kingdoms. And they who keep their second estate shall have glory added upon their heads forever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever. Sort of like a pyramid scheme, except not. Because, you know, God.
Verse 27.
And the Lord said, whom shall I send? And one answered like unto the Son of Man, here am I, send me. And another answered and said, here am I, send me. And the Lord said, I will send the first.
Verse 28.
And the second was angry, and kept not his first estate. And at that day, many followed after him. And thus ends chapter 3. Tune in for chapter 4 that will be published as soon as I get around to it. So set your watch to Kolob time.
Hi, this is Chad from Orem, Utah. And I have met one of the three Nephites. You can comment on this episode on the website, infantsonthrones.com. And if you really like what you hear, give the Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes. I did. Anybody for the closing prayer?
Thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones.
Reach out to reach out and touch faith.
And look, if you've made it this far to the end of the episode, why not go and support us on Patreon? You can sign up for as little as $1 per episode, and you can cap that at whatever you want to for the month. So if you don't want to give us more than $4 a month, do $1 an episode for 4 times a month, and it'll cap it at 4, even if we do 200 episodes in the month. So then we can't trick you and get $200 from you. But this is a volunteer effort that we do with the podcast. If you want to help out, it would be really appreciated. I would appreciate it. Thank you very much, and thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones.